Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're here to continue our expectations series. Got a big pairing for you today. David Ajabo, the fourth-year outside linebacker, and Tyler Lindebaum, the fourth-year center. A couple of guys at, needless to say, a crossroads of their career. Joining me to talk about them is Jonas Schaefer. Jonas, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken. Great to be back on with you, talking about these guys during this wonderful series you have going.
Always a pleasure to talk football with you, Jonas. And Jonas is at the Banner, part of, I imagine, a very large team that worked on the Justin Tucker story. Is that correct?
Yeah. And hopefully that's the only time we'll have to do a story on a alleged serial offender. Although with the Ravens' recent draft picks, you never know.
All right, let's leave that there. I don't want to go way down that rabbit hole, unfortunately, but I hope the talk does get back to football on the currently rostered players. and that's something that we seem to sometimes have difficulty doing. Anyway, the undercard of this, as you might guess, is the David Ajabo, who's in his fourth year, coming off of, you know, what has been a very unproductive first 3 years of his career. He turned 25 in May and has 23 snaps as a rookie, 83 more in year two, and jumped up to 292 in year three, where he's active for most of the games. I think it was 13 games he was active for. Still primarily a situational pass rusher at this point. He is a guy, by the way, we heard all that stuff coming out of Michigan that, oh, the floor on his run defense is so high that, you know, he can't possibly underperform, you know, where we got him at number 45. He's a steal.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what do you think about his run defense in general?
I'm not particularly impressed with it. I mean, it certainly hasn't been a standout feature. I don't think that he's a guy who sets the edge particularly well. But the point I'm making is just that he really hasn't been used on that basis. I mean, right. I forget what his actual division of snaps was, but I think it was about 2-1, maybe even higher than that. Pass to run this last year. So the notion that he was going to become a really good run defender, just it hasn't panned out.
Yeah, I went back and watched a couple of his, I watched the last two games of the 2024 regular season. I thought he was fine against the run. I think you can tell that he has plus wingspan, plus arm length relative to his position, even though there isn't a whole lot of sand in his pants. I guess I'm a little bit optimistic about what he could be next year as a run defender, a year further removed from that ACL. So just him being competent as a run defender, I think, was a relatively pleasant surprise, because it gives you some confidence that maybe if the pass rush game comes along for him as well, he could be a guy who they count on for first down, second down snaps next season. So I think, you know, you're not going to stick him in there as a strong side outside linebacker. You're not going to expect him to be Malik Harrison next year, certainly. But I think I was okay with what I saw last two games of the season as a run defender.
Okay, I just looked it up. It's 77 of 294 snaps or as a run defender. I mean, playing basically 25% of your snaps as a run defender is ridiculously low. It'd be absurdly low in college. The typical one I was looking at, all kind of edge players and whatnot, was, you know, about 54%, 55% pass snaps they would play. But Ajabo is pretty much been exclusively a situational rusher in terms of his time with the Ravens. One of the things we've kind of been hoping for, I think, is that Chuck Smith would, you know, have him take a step forward as a pass rusher. I'll leave it to you to start that conversation.
there are some moves that he tries. they don't always work. He likes to try the classic cross chop that, you know, Yannick Ngakoue was most famous for, and that other guys have adopted for their own arsenal. Doesn't really seem to land it all that often. He doesn't really have a whole lot of counters because he's not at this point fast enough to really threaten along the outside edge. You know, I think there was a spin move late in the season that he tried, which was obviously the changeup that he had at Michigan, that again, he just doesn't have a fastball quick enough, a fastball strong enough to play to. So, you know, I'm not expecting, you don't need like four or five moves at this point to be a premium edge rusher. You just need a couple that are reliable for you and that complement each other well enough. And, you know, I guess you could say that he is trying, and that maybe he's putting together some stuff that he didn't have in previous years. Although I guess you'll say that the production on a per play basis doesn't really measure it. But compared to someone like Adisa Isaac, who, when I went back and watched his tape from last year, just didn't really have a plan at all. I think there was some evidence of him being able to do some good stuff. And like, if he can just get himself athletically to a point where he is able to overwhelm these slower footed offensive tackles more often, then I do think you see some of the natural bend and, you know, ankle flexion that you did at Michigan, where he's, you know, if you're able to attack, you know, half man as an offensive tackle, like he did on that first sack against Kingsley Suamataia against the Chiefs, and that makes the finishing job a little bit easier. But obviously, you know, watching those last two games of his, there weren't a whole lot of examples of him either being overwhelmed, him being able to overwhelm anyone either technically or athletically as a pass rusher.
So probably more than anything, in terms of looking at this year's pass rushers in the draft, the thing I'm looking for is the guys who have outstanding get off to create a outside half. It's usually the speed half man advantage that forces the overset from an offensive tackle. And Ajabo and Owe have both been extremely frustrating in that regard, to different levels, obviously. Ajabo's get off has not been there the entire time he's been with the Ravens, very slow off the ball. And Owe also, that's been the thing that's held him back. He's otherwise a spectacular athlete, you know, better than anyone he'll face at tackle, but he's not quick enough to threaten the edge in a way that creates the overset that would allow him then to counter and do that. And you and I had talked about James Pierce, you know, on your show that's the basic reason why I liked him so much. Ravens obviously didn't have a chance to get him in the end. It's also the reason I love Mike Green, is he's very fast to the edge in terms of doing that. Ajabo is never going to be that guy, it would be my feeling at this point. And I think we have to look honestly now at the crowding at the position and really ask, is there room for him at all in this fourth year? You've got a unit that has Owe Van Noy, Green, Robinson, and Isaac. And usually, very typically, you'd only roster five outside linebackers. Where are you? Are you high on his chance to make the team? Do you think he's a likely trade candidate? Where are you in terms of that?
I don't think you would get a whole lot for him as a trade piece. But again, maybe if all you're looking for is a fifth or sixth round pick.
Conditional seventh. I think that's what he draws right now.
It's possible. I think some team would be willing to take a chance on a guy who's a year removed from the, you know, who's now 2 years away from that ACL injury. I guess I would push back a little bit on his get off. I think early in his career, even coming off the Achilles, he did have a good get off. I remember checking. And again, maybe this was just like a function of him being a situational pass rusher, but checking when I still had access to it, like the Next Gen Stats get off measurements, which was like, you know, the privileged information that I had through someone who worked at ESPN, he was like in elite category. I think he was like 0.6 seconds get off, which, you know, is very, very good. It's like up there with Garrett and Watt and those guys. But obviously it was everything else that was a problem. And even now, I still think, you know, you watch him take off the line of scrimmage compared to the guys that he's rushing opposite from. I do think from A to B, he can get there quicker than the other guys on this team. I don't know if that says more I don't know if that reflects more negatively on his compatriots than it does reflect positively on him. But it's just, you know, everything else that comes after. Like, is he strong enough to convert that speed into power? Is he, you know, gifted laterally enough to, you know, kind of hit guys with a crossover and go from outside to in? I do think the thing that I would want the Ravens to maybe make more use of, if they feel comfortable, you know, giving him more pass rush reps, whether it's the preseason or regular season, is using him more as a looper, you know, getting him involved in some more pass rush games, or maybe if you give him a little bit more of a runway and he's able to, you know, rip past that, you know, inside guard's face because he just doesn't see him coming, then that could be something that could, you know, gin up production for him. So to the bigger question of like where he is on this roster bubble, I guess I would say that he's probably on the right side of it. I haven't really sat down and done my 53. I just think that, like, if the Ravens coaches communicate to him that this is going to be an offseason where you're going to have to learn how to play special teams, then he has enough gifts there physically, and hopefully he can convert them mentality wise, that he could give himself, you know, he could be a guy who plays more than, what, 35% of the special team snaps like he did last year. And that would be his ticket to being on this team in 2025. But obviously, if he has no aptitude for that or no willingness to do that, and then the guy that we see in 2025 is much the same that we saw in 2024, then obviously the Ravens will probably have to either take him out of the mix or find someone else, you know, from that edge rusher scrap heap to potentially go in and be his replacement.
I don't think they're ready to give up on Isaac yet. And most of it is just tenure to go with that. I'm not saying he's shown more than Ajabo has on the field at this point, because he's, you know, coming into his second year and Ajabo's going into his fourth. You have 3 years of team control versus one. That's the big difference there. In terms of the special teams thing, he played 30 special teams snaps last year. He's on the field goal block unit, and he was some on the punt return unit. He's really more of a block guy. He's an inside guy that they're trying to get through to the quarterback. So McLean did that, for example. Could he play more special
teams? I think I was looking at the I was looking at the defensive snap share, not the special team snap share. So yeah, 7% snap share for him in special teams.
That's about right. Yeah. So I don't see him like taking Harrison's place for that, or Board's place, or even Welch's place. I think he's I really don't see him with more than just the one unit responsibility. And that, even that is a, okay, field goal block. He can continue to be on that, but the punt return unit, he's really on there to block. He might not even be on there for every snap when he plays those games. Cause my guess is there were probably more punts that he was not part of the plan for that punt play. But we could take a look at that. He was a healthy scratch several times this last season, which is not a good thing, but that's where the Ravens healthy scratches come from. A lot of the times they come from the players who don't play special teams, and that they're the end of their position group in terms of where they are. And I look at this season, looking forward, Carson Vincent is going to be on the roster the entire season. I don't think they're going to IR him, because I think they want to get him developmentally at practice the whole year, getting the coaching they really want him to get. So I think they're going to need to hold him on the 53. Obviously, they cut him, they're going to lose him immediately because he's the size and shape pool that you lose it. Greg Sinnott, same thing. They lost him right away as soon as they cut him. So once you have that kind of pressure on your roster, it really creates a lot of pressure for your other guys to be actual contributors among the game day group. Cause you always have some walking wounded you're dealing with. So you got two or three guys who are going to be, you know, they're out for a week or they're out for 2 weeks, but you don't want to IR them because that would be overlapping with time where they could be healthy. But in terms of Ajabo, he's one of the natural guys to healthy scratch if you have a otherwise functional unit of outside linebackers.
Yeah, if you want to be pessimistic on his chances, but optimistic about the Ravens still being able to keep him, I think this is brought up earlier on Twitter today, in light of him being, you know, given that international player protection exemption status, which means that he can be like the 91st player on the offseason roster. It doesn't really offer a whole lot of protections for him being on the 53 because of some rule changes last year. But it was pointed out in that thread that his salary for 2025, I think, is $1.7 million, which means that if the Ravens were to cut him and another team were to claim him, they would have to be dang sure that he could contribute, because even though $1.7 million isn't enough or isn't a lot, that's still a good amount for a guy who you're probably seeing that the Ravens already gave up on. And you would have to be very, very bullish on that you could actually get something out of him, because, you know, $2 million is still a good amount of a chunk of change for a guy who's this young, but really hasn't shown a whole lot.
Just to be clear, that has nothing to do with the international component. That's just cutting a second round draft pick in year four. And Bronson Cafusi and Kamalai Correa were examples where they had to cut loose at a certain point. And they did end up trading Correa for a six, right? So I guess that's possible. If they're going to trade Ajabo, that it might be a little more because it's a pass rusher and a fairly high pedigree player. I just don't see the Ravens as having room for it unless there are multiple teams that are interested in taking a chance on him, and there might be. Then I don't see a big market for him. I think that if there's one team and they think they're the only team, I say go ahead and cut them. We'll pick them up then. They're not going to be that. That interested in trading a draft pick for him. But that said, a lot of people don't value their seventh round draft picks or their sixth round draft picks, and you might get something
right
in exchange. Yeah. We talked a little about the pressure there. I do think it's a case probably of the Ravens' depth holding up. And we've already seen today the Ardarius Washington injury that the Ravens' depth at safety did not hold up. So now they're in scramble mode trying to figure out what to do at that position. We don't need to go into that right now, but I'm just saying if there is an injury in the outside linebacker group, even one that just starts the season, you know, has to go on IR for four games, that could be Ajabo's ticket to being back on the roster, at least on a limited basis, to start the year.
Yeah, or maybe he gets hurt in the preseason and the Ravens put him in IR, and while he's recovering, someone else gets hurt, and that way he's able to stay on the team. Obviously hoping that everyone stays healthy, but there are a lot of ways where he could kind of backdoor himself into a roster spot if his preseason can't build on what he showed in 2024.
Yeah, great point, too. And the Ravens love to build their roster replacement in at the start of the year, including carrying extra guys on IR. I'm not exactly sure who the guys are on this team now, who they would cut and then return. But they have two spots that are just designated for that now for IR that they don't have to play the Brent Urban, Anthony Levine game with. The handshake deal game.
Yeah. Let me bring up the depth chart now. I guess you could do it with someone like Ricard.
No, he's signed. He can't be anybody's making over the minimum. Effectively, he's making over the minimum.
Okay.
So it has to be. It would be a player like Tylan Wallace, except he's making like 2.1, including void years. Those would trigger. It could be Ricard if it were a normal year, but it can't be. Harrison was a guy last year that I think was on the vet benefit already, special salary. So you're down to, I don't know who the players that have, the Ravens have, or in their fifth year who are making vet men, fifth, sixth, seventh year.
Yeah. On that note, that there is this very, and this is going to, hopefully no one else is going to steal this story idea, but I think it's on Over the Cap. If you go to overthecap.com/texture, it gives you a sense of just like, basically how teams are building their rosters through the prism of the salary cap. And what I've noticed, and it's not all that surprising, but it ties into like kind of this idea of the, I guess it's a little bit separate from this idea of like the Ravens not having this like cheap middle class, but they are now heading toward this very, very polarized place where they're going to have like close to the most high-end contracts in the NFL and also close to the most rookie contracts in the NFL, which means that like the middle class of guys who are making like a Patrick McCary type deal are going to get squeezed out. And obviously that doesn't really have anything to do with, you know, a Brent Urban being on this team and being fungible in salary cap space wise. But that's something that I just keep thinking about, like how interesting this team is from a roster build perspective because of, one, how well they've drafted, two, how many of those draft picks they're going to have to sign, and three, how many draft picks they continue to accrue to make this whole roster build enterprise possible.
Right. All right. I'm looking through the roster. It looks like the one guy who I can see, and they'd eat about $100,000 in guaranteed money, which I don't know how they would have to rejigger, but Jake Hummel is a guy who they just acquired for special teams, who I can't tell if he's got anything beyond $100,000 in guarantees, but he makes the vet minimum, and he could be a guy they handshake and re-sign, I suppose. I just think he's a guy that probably has some value across the league.
Is Ben Cleveland at $1.17 million on the vet minimum?
Oh, yeah. No, he's another one who might make sense. He is another one. And he's also probably a risk that you lose him if you do it. But, you know, he signed this contract. You're right. Ben Cleveland would make sense.
Yeah.
Anthony Miller is sitting down there. If he were to make the team, which is not going to happen, or Keith Kirkwood, you know, they're making the team. But Ben Cleveland will make the team, though. He'd be a good example of someone who it could be done for.
Right.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, let's move on. Talk about what makes a good and a great season for David Ajabo. What's a good season to you look like?
I think just building on some of what we talked about, carves out a bigger role on special teams, regains some of that burst from what he showed at Michigan, improves his cross drop, brings back the spin move, and then somehow carves out a role in the top four of those edge rushers. So if he is number four on the totem pole behind Adafe, Kyle Van Noy, Mike Green, leaving Tavius Robinson and Adisa Isaac in the dust. And that's not outside linebackers. That's just those DPRs or those obvious passing downs guys. If he could be number four on that totem pole, I think that would be a good season.
Yeah. Okay. I'm with you on that. Good season for me. I'll just read mine since it's very similar. Injury gives him a roster opportunity and some playing time, and roster/defense composition allows him to keep the spot even if others return. So it could be one injury happens, then another injury happens, and meanwhile, he's safe on both ends of that. Works hard with Chuck Smith to improve his effectiveness as a situational pass rusher. You define it in terms of some specific moves. I want to see some good counter move come in there as part of that. Yeah. Carves out a role of 200-plus snaps. I hit 292 last year. So it shouldn't be that hard to get 200 snaps, and yet I think it kind of will be for him to get that in what is likely to be his final year as a Raven, but plays well enough to get another opportunity somewhere in 2026. So he'll be a veteran, somebody, you know, obviously be a free agent after this year. Somebody will probably want to sign him, and I'm sure someone will give him a chance in year four here if the Ravens cut him. Right. But I don't think I think he's one of the bubble guys. And in fact, Jonas, you and I both know the easiest article to write in all of camp is who are the Ravens at risk of being cut. All you got to do is that look at that 10-year column, and the year four players are the ones who are in the most jeopardy.
Yeah, although I can't really think of like the last high profile year four guy who actually did end up getting cut.
I mean, there's been a lot of them over the years, and they don't end up being high profile guys because they're who is it? The corner Jackson, yeah, I want to say.
I guess they cut Pepe Williams.
That's a good one.
They cut Kaya Blue Kelly after his rookie year. So that's not really, yeah. But like guys who make it that long. I'm just talking about like guys who make it into year four in Baltimore. I feel like generally have enough staying power to sustain themselves for that fourth year roster push. But just kind of looking at the list of draft picks, none of these are really sticking out to me.
Okay, yeah, that's the place to look at. I was trying to think of what's the best way to kind of figure this out based on where we start. But let me go quickly, because I think Gooden is a guy, if you're going back a few years, who didn't make it there. And if you're talking about a second, a third, or fourth round pick, I mean, Kamalai Correa and Bronson Calfusi were both gone. That's a few years back, but yeah. Okay. I have some trouble bringing this up on my screen for some reason.
Want me to go into great season for Jabo?
Yeah, go ahead, and I'll think of this for a second here. What we do this? Yep.
All right. I think there is like the slightest of chances that he comes back just looking like a completely different guy. Obviously, this is kind of an apples and oranges comparison because the David Ajabo at Michigan had not been through the hell medically that the David Ajabo in Baltimore has gone through. But if you want to be optimistic, you can say like, hey, in 2020, David Ojabo had zero sacks for Michigan, and I think like six games. Next year, his breakout year, he has 11. So there is this precedent in a completely different circumstances, but you know, it's there nonetheless, that there is this possibility for a huge, huge breakout. And I think my comp for him, and it's actually funny because this guy was, I think, taking 20 picks after David Ojabo in that 2022 draft, was Nick Benito. And if you want to compare their measurables, they're actually pretty similar. Like, I think Benito was a 4.56 guy. I think David Ojabo was 4.55 guy. David Ojabo actually has like a better wingspan. I think he's a little bit better built, but I think there is like the small chance that if he just comes back, if he looks like his old self again, if he can be that guy who can tear off the edge, then maybe he is the poor man's Nick Benito. And like, that would be, you probably have to be the very, very poor man's Nick Benito, like the Nick Benito on food stamps, because I believe Nick Benito had 15 sacks this year for Denver. But, you know, like if you become that, if you get a guy who maybe gets 7-8 sacks this year, earns coaches' trust as an early down run defender, plays well enough to either, you know, get the kind of buying the dip proposition from Eric DaCosta, where he gets like a mid-season extension, or just plays himself into a nice deal somewhere else. It's not out of the realm of possibility that he becomes kind of out of nowhere the classic fourth-year Ravens edge rusher breakout. You know, fits all the Kruger. Checks all the boxes for that prototype. Exactly. You know, Za'Darius Smith, Matthew Judon, blah, blah, blah. So I'm still very skeptical of that, but there is, you know, I forget if you, Ken, were there for like those practices in training camp last year where like he looked like maybe the best edge rusher that they had. It was a very, very small sample size. It didn't last super long. It took you kind of had to wait until the dog days at camp for maybe when everyone was kind of wearing down for him to get there. But there were definitely some flashes where this guy who, you know, not even what, like 10 months removed from that ACL injury was still, you know, giving these tackles a lot of trouble. So I'm not willing to write him off completely. I still think that there is enough physical talent there that hopefully he can recover some of, that he could be a good pass rusher in the right system. But obviously that is like that's the 99th percentile outcome for him this year.
I think, you know, I think that's fine. And you're saying it certainly in terms of what's the range of outcomes way. That's a reasonable way to think about it. The thing I remember primarily about David Ojabo from this last camp was something I'm sure you remember as well, was him getting knocked to the ground, knocked on his rear end by Kadir Ishmael. And that creating this back and forth between Ishmael and the other outside linebackers, who were basically not liking, I think, how hard he was playing is basically what they were not liking about him. Because later in camp, he had an incident where Owe like stood over him for a while, effectively teabagging him in a way that was just a strange moment for a couple reasons. First of all, good for Kadir Ishmael to get the attention of the outside linebackers that he's playing so hard and they don't like it. Good for him, because he's doing the things he needs to do to make an NFL team. It's not a good look for Adafe Owe to look like a bully to a player like Kadir Ishmael who is probably not going to make the team, and he would have known it at that moment that was the case. It was a strange situation, but he got under his skin and got under the outside linebacker skin in general. And I think it really was stemmed from knocking a job out of the ground. I think that was when they started to believe that he was playing too hard. So
yeah, I mean, right, that is the thing that sticks out. You go back and watch that the Texans tape, and again, not a great Texans O-line, but that one of those games near the end of the year, and he does end up on the ground a couple times. And whether you're playing defensive line or offensive line, if you're getting knocked to the ground more than a couple times a game, then that means that you're probably not ready for this level.
Yeah, it's generally speaking, it's a bad thing. Let me go on to his great season. I'd say his get off improves. I don't know where exactly that comes from. You're mentioning his get off as measured somehow was great. I maybe I need to say it differently. Maybe I need to say it that he's able to leverage his get off into something that's meaningful right. in terms of pass rush impact or pressure or counter or whatever it might be. But we had the opportunity to regularly comment on the violence of his hands, which is something I don't think, you know, we talk about it with Matt Abike all the time. I don't think we talk about it with David Ajabo. And it's something that was supposed to be really good about him. He's not really a powerful half man player. So he's not a guy or for that matter, he doesn't have a real top end bull rush either. He's a guy who, you know, is really struggling to find what's combination of things is going to work for him as a pass rusher in this league. Compound moves take a step forward and are well timed. That's, you know, him working with Chuck Smith, and hopefully they really are going to get to it this offseason. Pass rush productivity creates a good problem with Owe, Isaac, Ajabo, Green, and Van Noy, all deserving pass down snaps. I think Robinson is well placed where he is as a run defender primarily, who can give you a little pass rush juice on the early downs. I don't think he needs to move into that group. The Ravens make good use of his skills with OLB heavy packages, rush nickel, and race car. That's a place where Ajabo could find a role, by the way, because the Ravens now, particularly if they got into a situation where Travis Jones gets hurt, could be relying more on probably rush nickel more than race car. Rush nickel, 3 outside linebackers, race car, 4 outside linebackers, for those who don't know the terminology I typically use, to close out games. So the Ravens have 2 touchdown lead in the fourth quarter. Get David Ajabo on the field, kick him inside, and see what he can do for you.
Right.
You mentioned looping. I want to see him be an underneath player. He's a guy, admittedly, there's half man difficulty there, and maybe there's more quickness than there is the ability to exploit a pick that he sets, in terms of quickness to loop. But I think the half man advantage is typically where your big advantage comes. It's not generally understood. People think the looper is typically the guy you're trying to set free to get a great passer. It's not usually the case. It's usually the underneath guy you set up with a half man move. And 2 half man blocks that then is freed by the peeling lineman who has to pick up the looper. That guy, and whether it's been Tim Jernigan or Price or Nada or others in the past, has done really well in that. And I think that could be Ajabo working on the inside on some guard crossing moves. It certainly can be others like Matt Abike and whatnot who are quite good at it. And then the last thing is that the Ravens consider him among the 2026 options in the event both Owe and Van Noy depart. So that's one of the hopes, is that he might still be a reasonably cheap option in 2026 to continue right. the roster and continue some of the pass rush, because they're going to lose a couple of pretty big pieces, as I see it, prior to that 26 season.
Yeah, and to your point about the pass rush games, I think he was an inside guy on one of Matt Abike's sacks. I believe it was against Cincinnati, where they inverted their usual spot. So I think Matt Abike was
on the outside.
And Ajabo was the inside. It wasn't like a great move or anything, but you know, just when Matt Abike is able to get low and build up some steam, and you know, working against that terrible Bengals interior, he may look pretty easy. And you know, you give the tip of the hat to Ajabo for at least helping to set him up on that nice sack.
You got a good memory. There's that play, and I think there's one other in the season where it happened. Guys just looked at his PFF position, snaps by position. He's showing with 2 that are not as a outside linebacker there. So that's a good one. Yeah. All right.
And before we, like, I probably should have done this at the start, but I do think it's useful to maybe remind people of the context of, like, his career in like those 4 sacks, because there was a lot of, I think, a lot of optimism about like what he did in 2022 and 2023, because they were kind of high impact stuff. Because I think both of those, the first 2 sacks of his career, were both strip sacks, but yep. They weren't high quality sacks. I went over the 4 sacks that he's had in his career. I think just one of them I would consider a high quality sack. The first one that he gets, he's like working over Jonah Williams, who allowed 12 sacks that year when Ajabo was a rookie. It takes him like 4 seconds to turn around the arc. You know, he runs into a scrambling Joe Burrow, brings him down. Next year, he beats a Michael Dieter for the Texans, who was stepping in at right tackle, and according to Texans reporters, might not have played a single snap out wide in all of training camp. In fact, if you go look at Michael Dieter's PFF snap counts, that one snap at right tackle is unaccounted for. So I don't know why, but I believe that might have been the first and only snap at right tackle of his career, and it led to David Ojabo getting that strip sack. And then, you know, even last year, the one sack that he had against the Giants, it's just like him catching Tommy DeVito as he's kind of scrambling toward the line of scrimmage. And he only gets that sack because Michael Pierce can't get him. So, you know, it's, again, his career has definitely left you wanting. I understand the risk that the Ravens were willing to make when they drafted him in that second round. Maybe we're talking about, again, like an actual poor man's Nick Benito, if all he had to deal with was just that Achilles injury that he was coming back from. But again, there just isn't a whole lot to kind of hold your hat up to hang your hat on if you're a David Ojabo backer at this point in his career.
Let me ask you this. If the Ravens had it to do over, I think I know what the answer is, but scrapped his first year, NFI him for the whole year, and lived with the consequences of that with Ojabo. Ojabo clearly would have been very unhappy with it. But it would have been like Voorhees. They'd have brought him back for year two. You'd have been starting there. He'd now be entering year three right now. And he'd be in a completely different developmental spot in terms of expectations.
Yeah. And maybe you or I get the chance to ask him that. I think he would probably say that he's happy where he is. He's glad he, you know, lived through that experience. I'm sure he would say that this was all God's plan, because that is his default answer when you ask him about anything big picture. But certainly you could argue that, you know, getting that opportunity to redshirt and having this be year three instead of year four, the Ravens would be in better circumstances. But then again, maybe if he's only in year three instead of year four, then they don't feel as bold in taking Mike Green. and then they don't have a potential top 10 edge rusher in their building as a second round pick.
I think they probably were going to make that pick no matter what, based at where things were as 59 came up, because I mean, they had two guys leaving next year in Owe and Van Noy is another way to think defensively about that pick. I'll tell you what, I want to hear Eric DaCosta's answer to that question. I don't know if I'll get the truth out of him, and he doesn't get to the podium much, but you go ahead and ask Ojabo, and I think you're right. I think you got his response exactly pegged. I'll ask EDC the next time we get access to him, and I'd really love to hear his answer on that one. All right, let's move on.
Very, very satisfactory.
No, probably not in either case. And you know, we just, it'll be a matter of we kind of predicted it was that way. Yeah. All right, let's talk about Tyler Linderbaum again. Obviously, also at a big crossroads in his career, entering his fourth year. The big thing for him is just the recent news that they did not pick up his fifth year option, which is going to be $23.4 million. Nobody in the know was predicting that option would be picked up. It would change the whole leverage of any negotiation. It's $5.4 million higher than the AAV for Creed Humphrey, who's the best center in the game. So it wouldn't have made any sense for them to pick up. It's paying left tackle money effectively for a center. That said, the Ravens were forced on May 2nd, or I guess a couple days before that is when they actually announced it, into the uncomfortable position of saying, hey, we're picking it up on Hamilton, but we're not picking it up on Linderbaum, but our intention is to sign both of them long term.
Yeah, and it made total sense. There is, I guess, the possibility, even though it would be a more costly proposition than the fifth year option, that if he has a lights out year, or they really don't want to lose him, that they slap the franchise tag on him after this 2025 season as a negotiating tool, just to extend that negotiating window. But you know, that would cost more. I think the projections are that it would blow past that fifth year option total by a couple $1 million. And obviously the Ravens, given the current state of their 2026 salary cap, cannot really afford to be just throwing away millions of dollars if indeed Tyler Linderbaum has any intention of signing that, which I don't think he would unless the Ravens just are insistent on lowballing him. So yeah, it's gonna be a really interesting year, because you know, the next time that we get the chance to talk to him will be the first time since the Ravens turned down that option. And he didn't, you know, he sounded kind of resigned to it if you were reading between the lines when we talked to him during OTAs. But you know, it's, I don't think it's going to be causing any bad blood between him and the Ravens or his agent and the Ravens.
I think they can completely explain the situation as this is a bad mechanic at the CBA, that's where the right problem lies. It's not in anything you did. We believe in you as a player, et cetera, et cetera. And I think they do. I think they believe in what he brings from a leadership angle, which is much harder to qualify than the what did he actually do on the field personally this last year, which is a source for some concern from my point of view. Not outrageous concern, but just he was maybe the second or third best center in the game a year ago at this time, and now he's maybe the fifth or sixth best center in the game as I would see it. I'll go through some of my reasons for this. But a lot of week-to-week variation in his game as I score it. That's not unusual for offensive linemen. He never had a game that dropped below the D range, but he did have four of those, and he only had four A's on the year. So to me, that was just not a great overall season, probably a C-plus season in aggregate. But in particular, if you're looking for bad games, look at Tampa Bay, Philadelphia, and you can see there's a common thread in these going through, or big guys. Week 18 versus Cleveland. Now, I don't remember who they had inside playing in that game because they went through a lot of injuries.
Yeah, he got walked back by Juwan Briggs, a no-name Browns rookie. Mm-hmm. I have these in my notes.
If you're looking for a better way to unwind, focus, or even get a good night's sleep, listen up. Let me tell you about Mood, the online cannabis company that's changing the game when it comes to functional gummies. They've crafted a whole line up of federally legal THC blends designed to help with everything from stress to sleep to mental clarity and even some spicier needs if you're into that. Now, what makes Mood different? They go beyond just THC. They pair it with herbs and adaptogens to create targeted effects that you won't find in any other dispensary. And every gummy is made with pesticide-free, small farm American cannabis. So you're getting quality that you can trust. I've tried their sleep gummies. And let me tell you, it takes about 15 minutes and I'm out cold, no grogginess, no weird side effects, getting some of the best sleep I've gotten in my life when I take one of these gummies. And if you need a mood boost, their Epic Euphoria gummies, game changers. And right now, Mood is giving listeners 20% off their first order by using the promo code RAVENS at checkout. So head on over to mood.com, find the perfect gummy for whatever life throws your way, and don't forget to use the promo code RAVENS to save 20%.
Going up. Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free Samsung 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
The best piece of financial advice I've ever received is to pay yourself first. That's why now with every paycheck I receive, I start by putting a little bit away for those rainy days. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns is a financial wellness app that makes it easy to start saving and investing for your future. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now, even if all you've got is spare change. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns recommends a diversified portfolio that can help you weather all of the market's ups and downs. Using Acorns, before I knew it, I had a couple $1,000s in a little nest egg account. Sign up now and join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $25 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/FMH or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/FMH.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same Game Parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
And then Sam Kamara, who I think was like a third year, again, completely an anonymous guy, who also gave him the business with a bull rush.
Oof. And then in the AFC divisional game versus Buffalo, I'd have to look back and see exactly what went wrong. One of his deductions for that game was the bad snap that ended in Lamar's fumble. I charged him with a half a sack on that play, even though it's not technically a sack. It has the same end result as one. I thought I probably was being very generous to Linderbaum to not call that maybe two-thirds his on the play. Certainly the bad snap was, to my mind, set up the entire bad situation there in terms of what it was.
Yeah, I went looking before, you know, as I was prepping for this pod, just to see if there were any of the analytical sites that chart bad snaps for centers. I couldn't find any. Maybe I'm overlooking something obvious, but in searching for Tyler Linderbaum bad snaps on Google, I did find a tweet from myself that I'd forgotten about, which was that, and maybe you didn't chart it this way, but I think there were also some iffy snaps in that Week 18 game, which was also another very cold game against Cleveland. I don't know if they led into anything super, super bad besides just maybe, you know, a kind of wonky looking Lamar scramble or, you know, wonky looking Lamar checkdown. But I guess I would flag that as a potential concern going forward with, I think Tyler probably has, just given his proportions, probably has pretty small hands. And, you know, that could be a potential source of problems, you know, in the cold when it gets a little bit tougher to grip this ball. It's also rock hard. So I guess just that's something to keep an eye on as the temperatures start to dip and the playoffs start to encroach, you know, on the regular season.
I'm looking at the source of all my deductions from that game right there. So he played 66 snaps in the game. He had 11 missed blocks in the game. So that means he's somehow getting beat. Some of those are in level two, some at the line of scrimmage. The ones at the line of scrimmage, I separate out in the article. So if you want to see that, go back and look at my article. I'm not talking you, Jonas, but whoever wants to know, go back and look at my article and you'll see maybe it's four, maybe it's five, whatever it was of those were losses at the line of scrimmage. And then he had two pressures allowed. And so that's going to be something where the cone was actually imperiled by what he did. And then two-thirds of a quarterback hit. I don't know if that's two times one-third or two-thirds of one particular event. I probably could figure it out. Yeah, it looks like it's two-thirds of one event is what that is. The other thing he didn't really do well in the second half of the year, I'll tell you, is every other Ravens offensive lineman got themselves together from a penalty perspective, with the exception of Linderbaum. Linderbaum was really the big problem. Falele didn't have any penalties down the stretch. Linderbaum I still have for 15 points of penalty deductions, which essentially would be like two holding calls, two false starts. And I think he might have had one other point where I believe the point I gave it to was in the Buffalo game, was there was a delay of game and I couldn't really tell whether it was on Lamar or the team in general for being too slow to get to the line of scrimmage, or whether it was on Linderbaum for not knowing. And that's what I recall from that game, is he was kind of looking around, wasn't set over the football in time to snap it as the play clock was running down. So anyway, it's really weird to have a 1 point penalty deduction for a game, because there's no individual penalty that would be worth 1 point. It's two is kind of the minimum. I remember it had to be one of those. The other way it sometimes shows up is if three linemen false start at the same time, but that's usually not the center. It's usually, you know, a guard, a tackle kind of thing.
Yeah. And, you know, as we were kind of talking before the show, the variance on the grades or the, you know, the next level, the analytics on Linderbaum are pretty interesting. I guess I'll start with the more cheery outlook. Fourth in ESPN's pass block win rate among interior offensive linemen, third among centers, which again, you know, measures, basically, are you doing your job within 2.5 seconds of the snap? PFF, he finished fourth overall, certainly better against the run. He was third overall among centers, just 18th against the pass. And then probably the more damning and the one that's aligned with your thinking, Ken, is from Sports Info Solutions. And so there were 31 centers who played 500 snaps last season. First, when I use this blown block rate, first means the best. So you're giving up the fewest blown blocks in the NFL for that particular season. So 31 centers played over 500 snaps last season. You could, you know, say it's about one for every team.
500 NFL. Pass block snaps or 500 total snaps?
Just 500 total. Mm-hmm. 500 total. So he finished 18th overall in blown block rate. So that would be like basically the 13th or 14th worst. He was 23rd in blown block rate on passes. So again, you know, basically in the bottom quartile of the NFL, 16th in blown block rate on runs. So again, right there in the middle. And again, you know, that leads to him being 18th overall in overall bone block win rate. And what's interesting is it's not necessarily a statistic that, if you compare it to the year before, is prejudiced against him, because in 2023, again, aligning with your own assessments of him, he was first overall in blown block win rate. So if you are just identifying variables for what could have been wrong with Tyler Linderbaum this year, you know, maybe it's just as simple as, you know, that kind of neck injury that maybe became the back injury during the season. He also dealt with, I think, a knee injury that was a little bit minor. Obviously, you know, he plays a physical position. He plays a whole lot of snaps. Maybe it's just simple as the fact that he wasn't anywhere close to 100% this past year, in the way that he was more healthy, more athletic, more whatever in 2023. But it did strike me as interesting that finally, Ken, you have someone who is counting all these snaps, doing the math on them, and finding that their math is much more closely aligned with you, because there's not a lot of other sites out there that are as kind of down on him as Film Study Baltimore.
Well, you know, I'm really not down on the player. I hate this like view that I'm polarizing, because you've actually said it correctly. You said there's not that many sites that are as down on him. So, have him graded as low would be the you know, kind of the way to say it. I'm not intending this to be a subjective grading system here. I really have a set of rules that I play right by. Everybody gets it, you know, so it's not supposed to be that way at all. I will say two things about the PFF thing. First of all, I would encourage people to completely discount any combined offensive scoring for centers. You need to look separately at the pass and run blocking. It characterizes it correctly. And by the way, PFF is outstanding at what they do. They look at the same things I do. They actually believe a lot of the same things I do. They're looking at the plays, and they have a negative even when they don't have a pressure on some of the plays he loses, where I might give him a portion of a pressure or even a whole pressure. But the fact of the matter is, we're watching the same football, okay? And I trust PFF more than any other group to do it correctly. What they've messed up is the weightings. They messed up the weightings for combining run and pass. They messed up the weightings for the importance of scoring on the 0 to -2 scale. And they tremendously messed up the weighting on penalties. And that's something I need to write a separate article, do a separate study of, to get exactly at that, is how much is the penalty weighting messed up? Because, you know, to me, for them, the highest negative you can get on an individual play is -1. On the opposite, it used to be -2, but it's -1 now for a holding penalty. And you know, you make two decent blocks sealing off your guy, and you've made up for your holding penalty. Bullshit. I don't know what football you're playing that you can, you know, imperil a drive in that way, and this could be true. Anyway, that's one of the reasons why he scored fairly low this year, is he had 10 penalties, which was right, second of all centers and fifth highest in terms of the rate. So that's a very serious negative component to his game. And, you know, I love PFF. Their people are great. They always talk to me. And one thing I'll say that definitely works out in Linderbaum's favor is that in 2023 and 2024, both years, Timo Riska, who's their head of R&D, has a model that looks at the relative difficulty of the situation for blocking. It takes into account, I always called it an N factor model, because I don't know how many total factors are in. But he's told me some of them that are in there. It's the quality of the opponent, the down, the distance, the score in the game, etc. And his level of difficulty is always higher than average. And I don't know why that would be, by the way, because it seems like there'd be a lot of run plays that would be involved. But because we're talking pass blocking, maybe the Ravens have a more difficult set of pass blocking options. I can't really come up with the reason why it's true, personally, but he says it is. I believe him in terms of the what his model says, and that would say he's a slightly above average pass blocker still, even in 24, and was very above average in 23. So when we come back to the pass blocking thing, I'll just say I don't think Tyler Linderbaum's ever really going to be a dominant pass blocker. I just don't think that's who he is from a length and size and hand fighting perspective. I don't think he's at the top to do those things really well. But I think there's still hope for improvement, and that he could come back to be somewhere between where he was in 23 and 24. And you talking about the injuries really makes me think maybe that's the area that I can hope for transitory impacts to go away, that he'd be back and be a better play, better a pass blocker in this next year.
Yeah, and first of all, a lot to unpack there. I would pretty stridently disagree with like the environmental factors working against the Ravens. I don't know. On the one hand, Lamar improvising for as long as he does certainly does leave some guys to, you know, hung out to dry if you aren't unwilling or incapable of blocking for more than 3 or 4 seconds. I understand that. But also, like, how many games or how many situations do you see over the course of a normal Raven season where there is just like it's 3rd and 5, 3rd and 8, and you are getting the cage rush from the pass rush, which means that, like, if a nose tackle is in there or just, you know, the other team doesn't have a great defensive tackle that they feel capable of unleashing, it's just like they're kind of playing peekaboo with Lamar. And I think that's, again, a huge testament to Lamar and his value. But that's also, you know, you could say that that is like a, it's a mitigating, it's something that should be helpful to the interior lineman on this Ravens team, that you're not going to face the, you know, Mad Max Fury Road type interior rush.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Every game that, okay, that you would if you were a Matthew Stafford or Jared Goff or even like a Jalen Hurts, who is like mobile but not anywhere close to as mobile as Lamar Jackson. So I think that would probably be, again, baked into my concern if I'm being the Mr. Pessimistic about Tyler Linderbaum and his pass protection. Is like, yeah, he didn't have a great season last year, and also he has all these built-in advantages that should, you know, be conferred to someone who's playing on the, along the interior for this Ravens offensive line. Having said all that, even if he wasn't as great after the snap, you know, last year as he was in 2023, I don't think you can discount just that the growth that he and that group made before the snap. You know, when I did a story like October, November, just talking about how Lamar had grown as a pre-snap processor and how that was translating to, you know, his performance against the blitz and everything like that. And the quote that I pulled up, you know, I talked to Tyler Allen a little bit about it. He didn't really give me the full sense of what exactly his responsibilities were in terms of, like, you know, how much he's able to kind of pull rank and everything, because obviously Lamar has the final say. But he did say, quote, all of our plays have certain built-in protections of how we want to do things. And obviously our quarterback, he can override things. He's a little bit better picture than us, so he can get us into maybe a different protection or flip protection, stuff like that. But it's important for everyone to be on the same page, because at the end of the day, if one side of the line doing one thing and the other is doing another, you're not going to be successful. And I do think that you can credit him for a lot of what the Ravens were able to figure out and get settled offensively before a snap. You know, you didn't really see a whole lot of busted protections. And I do think that's one, because of like how smart Tyler is as a football player, and also just like how good of a leader he is during the week. You know, getting, make sure that he's in command of that offensive line room, getting everyone on the same page. It's clear that everyone in that offensive line room loves him, respects him. And, you know, that is the kind of stuff that is probably going to be a little bit hidden from view, but baked into the contract, the next contract that he gets in Baltimore, however big it is.
That's a great point. And, you know, one of the things we're doing is we're spending a lot of time focusing on Tyler Linderbaum's pass blocking because it's his weakness, but we should give due time to his run blocking, which remains outstanding. I only have one minor gripe about it. And really value what he brings as a leader. He played next to two guards who McCary had, you know, it's not like he'd never stepped in at left guard before, but he basically had never played any significant time there. And Falele was a rookie on earth in terms of playing the interior offensive line. So he was learning things and getting yelled at for, you know, a lot of camp, basically. We've been through this, by the way. I just want to take a slight sidelight right here. You could really tell last camp just how much Falele was Joe D's guy, even though Joe D was only there for that long at the beginning of camp, but he was yelling at him all the time. It's like, you don't spend that much time with a guy you don't love. You know, you yell at your children, you yell at your, you know, you fight with your brother when he's not doing what you need him to do in terms of, you know, some sports thing or, you know, running a business or something. You just don't spend that much time with somebody if you're giving up on them. And I think, you know, what I'm seeing right now so far is the Warhop-Vinson relationship. Man, are they tied at the hip based on what I saw at rookie mini camp And also what I saw in terms of just that short 30-second, 40-second clip they had where Vincent obviously was the one who bagged the table for him to get him drafted.
Yeah, I'm excited to get the chance to talk to Warhop, hopefully during OTAs, if not during minicamp, just because I think that is probably the, you know, in addition to the all the questions that we have about the starters, just like why he was so convinced that this guy who was so dreadful during the season against the Power Four competition he faced, why was he so convinced that this guy could be a dude eventually in the NFL?
It'd be a fun thing. I'll get to my one gripe here really quickly with Linderbaum, the run blocker, because I think he does all the things the best of any Ravens lineman in terms of getting to level two, making his blocks there, taking his block downfield. We've seen, you know, clips of Daniel Falele running way downfield or Ronnie Stanley running way downfield to make blocks that are encouraging. I think Linderbaum's leadership in that area has been particularly outstanding. The one thing I don't like is on combination blocks, I think he does not spend enough time pushing to get the defensive tackle or the nose tackle up on one pin. And it, you know, that's really the key to winning those blocks is you've got to leave the back guy, the trailer, the ability to be blocking a big fatty who's up on one leg. Then he's going to win the block. He's basically going to win the block 100% of the time. I see too much of Tyler trying to shove that guy. And that's almost like a pass blocking technique. When you want to make a help block, go ahead and shove the guy in the ribs, give him something extra to think about. But when on run blocking, you need to displace that guy and you need to put him in a position where he's off his pin and then you move to level two. And most players, there's a lot of tackles in the league, particularly when they down block, they look more like they want to hold on to that block too long. So they get kind of the pancake credit that goes with it, which by the way, I don't even give out pancakes when it's a double team like that. But if they're hanging around, they think somehow it's a more worthwhile block if they could put the guy on his ass, when really they should be going up at least that half level, trying to seal a linebacker. He's just the opposite. He's very, very unusual for an NFL offensive lineman that he's just this patty cake is the wrong word because it doesn't really get it, but this bump blocker as he moves up to level two. And it's my only complaint about him as a run blocker. Otherwise, all the mobility you'd want, all the ability to get downfield, all the ability and decisiveness to find people on level two. I like him a lot.
It's funny you bring that up because my big quibble with Tyler Booker as a potential Ravens first round target was that for a guy his size and with his raw power, he was not, in the games that I was able to watch, was not displacing people on those down blocks or on those double teams like I thought he should have. Like he had such great power as a pass blocker. You know, once he snatched onto you, you were just done for. But watching three or four of his games, all 22, he just wasn't, you know, aiming at the hip the way that I thought that he should have been to, you know, create that space for these Alabama running backs. And that was pretty disappointing. And maybe it's something that he'll fix, you know, right away in Dallas. But yeah, I'm curious to see how he develops there. My big thing with Tyler and the run blocking isn't necessarily a gripe with him. It's more so a big picture question about the system. Because, you know, what were we told, Ken, like when the Ravens drafted Tyler? It was like, this is a guy who coming out of Iowa had posted the like highest run blocking grade on zone runs in PFF history. And, you know, I don't know if I assume that's inside zone and outside zone, but when I think of zone runs, I typically think outside zone, you know, elephants on parade, just kind of getting guys in a position where you're able to have those three options of, you know, bang it, cut back, bounce it. And when you look at what the Ravens did last year, this is all from SIS. So they've had the just overall second most runs in the NFL last season, 554. Do you want to take a guess at how many outside zone slash stretch runs they had last year?
Outside zone slash, well, it might be a little bit hard to define, but I would say zone running probably was 62%.
Not
inside zone. Say again? Not inside zone.
Not inside zone. Okay. So just like just... The kind of stuff
I'm going to have a harder time splitting the remainder, but it's a subset of 62% is what I would say. But I can't give you a good answer on that.
According to SIS, the Ravens had 100 outside zone and stretch runs last year. So they had about 18% of their total runs were outside zone and stretch runs. So they finished 19th in the total tally of outside zone and stretch runs, despite finishing second in the NFL in total runs last year. And that to me is a reflection of the run blocking albatross that Daniel Faalele was. Like, I think if you had a guy who was a much better mover, then you could have, I don't know, like you have Tyler Linderbaum, who's great in space, as we saw time and time again with that screen game last year, which, by the way, we haven't even touched on. Like, I think a lot of what the Ravens were able to do with like their best in the league's screen game was because you have a guy like Tyler Linderbaum, who's so quick and so accurate when he, you know, zips up field and is able to make that first contact with that peeling off defensive end or linebacker or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you have Ronnie Stanley, who's a good mover in space. You have Roger Rosengarten, who I think has to be a good mover in space because he is not the biggest guy. He doesn't have the longest limbs. You know, Pat McCary, you know, decent athlete, nothing superlative or anything. And to me, like the comparison that I've been kind of workshopping in my thinking of Mission Impossible was like, you have Tom Cruise, but you're telling Tom Cruise that you can't do all these incredible stunts because you don't have like a stuntman who looks like him. You know, like, why are you going to limit the superpower of this incredible player in certain respects because the guy who he's wedded to on that line, the guy who is his, you know, buddy along the right side, just can't make those same kind of athletic movements. And I think that's a shame. Like, imagine telling someone that the Ravens had the best run game in the NFL last year and Tyler Linderbaum was a big part of it, but it looked nothing like what he did at Iowa. That's a credit to just like his versatility and to Lamar and to Derrick Henry and everyone else, but it is still kind of mind-blowing to me from a big picture perspective.
So Daniel Faalele certainly has a lot of limitations as an athlete. And he also has some mental limitations that he can correct still going forward. I mean, he dropped his penalties to almost nothing at the same light switch on time that the safeties got it right on the back end of the defense. The offensive line was all getting it right in terms of turning off the penalties. Daniel Faalele also is a good pass blocker, and it's just not generally accepted. And anytime people want to like deny your thing, they show you one clip and they say, look at this. This is a good pass blocker too. Well, everybody has bad pass blocks. You know, once in a while, you live with it as part of the thing. Pass blocking is more important. And, you know, we had this conversation in the production meeting briefly, but if you're going to try and convince me that run blocking is more important than pass blocking, you might as well try and convince me that slugging percentage is more important than on-base percentage. I hope people will understand just how freaking ridiculous that is. In terms of things. So it's, you know, as many limitations as a run blocker, the Ravens ran for what last year? 5.8 yards per carry. It's one of the best offenses in NFL history. And this, it's really hard to say, well, you know, I'm concerned about what Daniel Faalele can do for us as a run blocker within a 5.8 yard per touch context. And then you also look, excuse me again. You also look at the passing game. And they weren't hurting there either, with one of the highest, you know, passer ratings in NFL history individually, and an incredible per attempt success. This was one of the greatest offenses that ever was. Daniel Faalele was a part of it. His contributions to it are non-negligible, and his growth within the season was also non-negligible. I thought he played the last five games of the year, and I thought he played exceptionally well. Some of that's not reflected in the way PFF scored it, but that's not how I scored it is all I can tell you.
Yeah. I forget who I'm stealing this from, and maybe it doesn't matter because again, there are no other offenses in the NFL that have a Lamar Jackson. There are no other offenses in NFL history that have had a Lamar Jackson, but I believe in this credo that like you should find a way to weaponize your most dangerous run blocker in whichever way you can. And obviously you can still get, you know, Tyler Linderbaum in space in gap schemes. But I just think that, you know, you watch him be able to scoop these three techs. You watch him be able to just beat guys to certain spots, you know, climb to the second level, take on linebackers, take on safeties. To me, aesthetically, I would much rather see him you know, function in a zone running scheme than the gap stuff that the Ravens have, you know, leaned more on over the past 2 years of the Todd Monken experience. I just wonder from a purely theoretical perspective, like what a Ravens run game looks like that, again, makes use of its best run blocker in the most maximalist way.
It's fair enough. We do also live within the era of the salary cap, so not everybody can be a 99 across the board in Madden ratings at each position. And having a Daniel Falele is part of what allows you to pay Lamar Jackson. So, you know, you need to have those guys who are cheap as hell starting somewhere, even though they might hurt you in some ways, in order to afford Lamar Jackson being part of your team. And it's also obviously makes every single decision you make be focused on how can we minimize the cap cost, given that our offense is completely centered on Lamar Jackson.
Yep, works for me.
All right. Let's talk about a good season and a great season for Tyler Linderbaum going forward. We ran over. I knew this would happen, but love talking football with you, Jonas. What's a good season for Tyler Linderbaum look like?
Just a refreshing what we've talked about earlier, just bounces back in pass protection, remains effective in the screen game, remains effective in the run game. And then obviously for him, most importantly, just avoids any of the injuries that could jeopardize a long-term deal, whether that's here or elsewhere.
Okay, I think that all good things. I'll just read mine verbatim. It's easier. Run blocking continues to be excellent, does not allow new guards to drag down his play. They will have a new guard, whether it's Voorhees or somebody else at left guard. Pass blocking continues near the top of the league, and I'd say recovers to the near the top of the league is what I should say, 75th percentile plus. But this is a year where some consolidation is probably going to be necessary. Now, one of the things I like about what you said earlier is maybe I can hope that there was a more of a transitory injury concern than I was really aware of. I remember the neck thing. I remember that holding him out in camp and whatnot. Of course, I didn't really realize that throughout the whole season he was dealing with a series of injuries. So in a way, that's kind of good because it explains some of what happened. But to me, that's a good season for
him. Yeah, and for me, a great season. Just building on all that, again, the great season is – the team weaponizing him more effectively in the run game, just like I talked about, stays healthy. You could argue that what we saw last year was him demonstrating a mastery of this offense before a snap, but you know, obviously the coaches, the players would know better than we would. So let's just say that, you know, in year three under Todd Monken, that mastery level is achieved. And then I think just overall, like he plays well enough. If they haven't gotten that extension done, that, you know, a franchise tag after next season is something that, you know, reasonable Ravens fans would agree is, you know, a viable option for this team in its team building process, even if obviously they don't end up paying him the $25 million or whatever the franchise tag is worth. But it's not such a ludicrous idea because he ends up getting, you know, I guess top of the market center money. I know that you don't think that he is going to, I know that you think he's not as good as Creed Humphrey, and I would agree with that. But as we've seen with quarterbacks, you don't have to be the best player at your position to get top of the market money, especially if you wait long enough.
Okay, I'll address that at the end, I think. Great season for me. Continues to be discussed as one of the best run blockers in the league. Both guards fit in well with the Ravens' offensive line. Provides outstanding cone protection. I'm really talking about the IOL with that in the top quartile of the league. Combination of better hand fighting and improved play from the guards allow him to recover near the 2023 level as a pass blocker. Again, I don't think he's going to get all the way there. In the discussion for Pro Bowl, with overall success of the Ravens offensive line, so they credit him with that portion of that for his leadership, and the Ravens are able to sign him to a long-term deal without resetting the center market. Okay, resetting, here's what I mean. I don't want him to be $2 million higher or even $1 million higher than Creed Humphrey. If he's $250,000 higher than Creed Humphrey, well, he signed his deal, what, 8 months later or something, so maybe I can come up with some reason why that might be true. But I think about the highest I'd be willing to go is Creed Humphrey inflated for 1 year of salary cap growth, reduced by 3% or something to reflect the fact that he's not as good as Creed Humphrey, which is going to take him down. That part is going to take him down, $500,000. And the inflation is probably going to take him up 13% or something. So, yeah, maybe you can get to $19 million somehow on him. The Cam Jurgens deal is just, it's basically the Deshaun Watson deal again. Cam Jurgens is a middle-of-the-pack center being paid enormous money, and it's as bad a contract as the Deshaun Watson deal is. It's just, it's ridiculous. And the Ravens won't fall into the trap, I don't think, although Linderbaum's people will certainly use it as leverage. They'll certainly point to it and say, well, look, Creed Humphrey, that may not be the reasonable market, but it's also an older market. Cam Jurgens, this is the current market for centers. Look at this. I think the Ravens need to be smart at that point. And I think basically part of what they'll need to do in 2025 is to look for what the alternative options are, because they just can't afford to go pay over by $8 or $9 million over the term of the contract for Linderbaum, in terms of a market setting deal. I'd be really dead set against that.
I did not realize until just now, looking up his PFF profile, just how downright middling Cam Jurgens was last year. 4 sacks allowed, 6 penalties. I mean, I guess he's got the longevity, and I think he's athletic enough that they feel like he's going to grow into it. But very surprising that guy is number 2 on the center salary list.
It's a shocking thing, and honestly, he goes also in the wrong direction. Same way as Linderbaum does in terms of run and pass block. He's better run blocker than he is a pass blocker, which is terrible. You don't want to pay that guy. You don't want to pay that guy as much anyway. But he's a lot worse than Linderbaum in both areas. It's the thing. Linderbaum is clearly better. He's got all the argument in the world that he should be making more money than Cam Jurgens. But there's also all the common sense in the world that tells you he should be making a lot less than Creed Humphrey. So I don't know how this resolves itself. I really don't. If they give him the same contract as Creed Humphrey, I mean, that creates an immediate disadvantage in terms of how you're paying your players relative to one of the Ravens' top rivals. Is it that material in terms of everything? Maybe not, but I'd be looking for alternatives. I think it's got to be a right player, right price situation if he wants to reset the market by millions of dollars.
Yeah, and I don't know how much Pro Bowls matter in contract negotiations besides just the tweets that get sent out when they're announced. But, you know, like if you're convincing yourself that Tyler Linderbaum not making a third straight Pro Bowl would help depress his market or depress his value in contract negotiations, then it's not that out of the question because, Steelers have a great young center. Broncos center who shows up very favorably in all these advanced metrics. Luke Wattenberg, obviously Creed Humphrey, I think is probably going to be a guy who's a perennial Pro Bowler, if not
perennial
All-Pro guy. So the road to assume that Tyler Linderbaum is just going to coast to Pro Bowl honors, a third straight Pro Bowl honor specifically this season, based on brand name alone. Maybe it's not that simple, and maybe him having again another quote unquote down 2024 could make people realize that there are other centers on his tier, and that he's not as elite perhaps as his folks would have Eric Costa and the Ravens front office officials believe.
Well, I don't wish him to not make the Pro Bowl. I think it would be better. Right. For the Ravens in general, first of all, I thought they kind of needed to get the deal done before May 2nd so they didn't have to go through the pain of discussing the fact they weren't picking up the fifth-year option. Unlike you, and I differ very sharply, obviously, in this regard, I do not see the franchise tag as any kind of a reasonable possibility because you'd have picked up the fifth-year option if that were a reasonable possibility because all it does is start the first year at a different point in different time, but still at a higher level than you'd like to pay. As being part of that contract negotiation. So I don't think you can do that with a $25 or $26 or $27 million number, whatever it be, because it's left tackle based. It's based on the top left tackles in the game, not the top centers.
I know.
And I don't see that as a reasonable option. So I think their next big milestone point will be the start of the season because he won't play in the preseason in all likelihood. So he's going to be effectively bubble wrapped until then in a lot of ways for risk of injury. And then each week after that, He'll take additional risk, and it'll be risk off the table for him as those weeks fly by, that he's not incented to sign a long-term deal with the Ravens. So I think that you know, he's incented more and more to test free agency and maximize his worth. I hope it works out for Linderbaum and the Ravens. I hope they can figure out what the dollar value is. The Ravens need to be careful, and there's a risk of underpaying him and letting him walk. There's a big risk of overpaying him and keeping him under that contract as well. I just say there's all paths have risk in this journey.
Yeah, and if you're the Ravens, you got to consider everything, including his age, which is, you know, him being only 25 means that by the time he's, you know, he's not yet in his physical prime. But if you are worried that he'll never reach that physical prime because of the injuries, especially the stuff with the back and the neck, then that would definitely make you a little bit gun shy about pulling the trigger on that deal.
All right. Jonas, always great talking football with you. You're literally one of my favorite people to spend any time talking Thanks. Football. You love when we get a chance at camp and love when we have you on the show. Tell folks where they can find your work online.
Yeah, just on X at Jonas_Schaefer, and then BaltimoreBanner.com. Obviously, it's going to be a little bit quiet until OTAs start, and then obviously even more quiet once we get to that summer hiatus, but should have some good stuff coming down the pipeline. I think my colleague Gianna is working on a Malachi Starks feature, and obviously, depending on when this is released, just a bunch of coverage from of the NFL schedule release, and then Paul Mancano and I have our own podcast just to discuss what's happening in Ravens world.
I would recommend that podcast, by the way. Really high level
discussion.
Sorry, say again.
We had a nice vigorous discussion about the draft.
Yeah, boy, those are some players we did agree on. They said they were not trying to set me up, but we really had major disagreements on these players. We talked about Shamar Stewart among other people, right? Among the group.
All the guys,
So it was a lot of fun. Anyway, really, really appreciate that. And by the way, if you want my biggest endorsement of Malachi Starks, I love the fact that the Ravens got, I certainly love the fact they got Starks now, given the injury news today, but I love the fact that they got Starks and Green in some order. I'd have been thrilled with that. Here's the two players you're getting in the first two rounds. I just said, you know, this is already looking like an A+ draft from what you get from those two guys at 27 and 59 with no trade up. No.
Yeah. I don't see how you can give the Ravens like lower than a B minus or a B, even if you hated all the day three picks, because the value alone of Malachi Starks as a day one guy, and then Mike Green, who's, you know, probably high rated on a lot of teams' boards, if not for the off field stuff. You know, like there's a reason why when you look at like the Jimmy Johnson trade charts, it's almost exponential with like the first and second round stuff compared to the lower stuff. Like you trade the fourth and fifth and sixth round picks to move up a couple spots in the second and first round. And so for the Ravens to get two potential impact guys in the first and second round, it almost doesn't matter like who they drafted on day three, because if the goal in every draft, you know, according to Daniel Jeremiah, is to get three starters, and you've already kind of 2/3 of the way there with Malachi Starks and probably Mike Green as well.
Could be as good a 1-2 as the Ravens have had since, they had some great ones, but I'll go back to Flacco and Rice as being a great combination in 1-2. Other folks out there, hit me up if you want to do a film study short. DMs are always open on Twitter. I'll have some of those mixed in with this expectation series, which should last us pretty much until July or almost the beginning of camp, but there'll be other pieces thrown in there. Look for our schedule article, which comes out on Thursday morning, and I'll have a podcast with that on Friday morning, GM, talking through what about the when did not work out for the Ravens with the schedule makers. They always seem to find a way to get screwed. We'll see if it happens this year. Jonas, thanks again for joining me.
Thanks, Kent. And you forgot the ultimate challenger to Flacco and Rice, which was Tyler Linderbaum's draft with Kyle Hamilton and Tyler Linderbaum going.
No, those are two ones, though, not a 1-2. But okay, you're good.
Still counts.
All right. And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study. We'll be right back.
country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton and adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.